And when you don't feel good for weeks and months at a time, depression, anxiety, fear, avoidance, social isolation, all of those emotional impacts begin to increase that level of pain.
Hey, I'm Lara, an artist, educator, and entrepreneur who's danced through life in Australia, London, and California. Now I'm an Aussie in Atlanta, Georgia, USA. Juggling roles as an artist, ex-dancer, current actor, author, professional educator, and qualified life coach, I'm also a wife and mother of two. Join me on this podcast, crafted for creative souls at every level, entrepreneurs, artists, dreamers, and hope-filled humans alike. I'm here to guide you towards a life of love, purpose, adventure, and boundless creativity. As a healthy, wealthy, and wise creative soul, I invite you to hit subscribe for weekly inspiration. Anticipate solo episodes, exclusive interviews with creative luminaries, and insightful discussions with my hottie hubby, Andrew, a specialist performance physical therapist, as we delve into the dynamics of relationships and more. Dive into a 360-degree view of making a creative life you'll love. Welcome back to the Healthy, Wealthy, Wise Artist Podcast. I'm Lara. And prevalent in the creative world, particularly within the freelancers, because of the nature of what we do as artists and creative entrepreneurs and big dreamers, I want to ask you this. Have you ever grappled with anxiety, struggled to complete daily tasks, faced physical dependency on substances, battled with eating habits, or been impacted by chronic pain? This episode is for you. Joining me in this episode is Dr. James S. Flowers, founder of J. Flowers Health Institute in Texas, and he's a recognized leader in chronic pain, mental health, and substance use disorders, and understanding the depth of the human condition. There's something for everybody, and it's from substance abuse to mental health and neurological health. So if you're ready to gain valuable insights and understanding into these crucial aspects of human health and improve your life as a creative or an artist or an entrepreneur or a big dreamer, stay tuned as we delve into the insightful conversation with Dr. James Flowers.
This interview has two parts. You're listening to part A.
Welcome, Dr. Flowers. What a beautiful name. How did you score such a lovely name? <You're> so lucky.
Thank you so much. Dino, I have to tell you, as a child, it was a very difficult name to have because
people
called me Flower Power and, you know, Pansy and, you know, all kinds of names in first, second, third grade. And now, I mean, my adult life from high school on, someone every day says to me, what a beautiful name you have. Oh, wow. And so I feel pretty cool.
Let's look at a little bit about your story and how you really got to your current position. Over 30 years of experience, I know, and including a fellowship in chronic pain. What's your story? What led you there?
Yeah. So in a little while, we'll probably go back to my childhood and talk about why I really chose my entire path. But really what led me there, I would say the most recent thing, 30 something years ago, that led me there was my undergraduate degrees actually are in marketing, finance, and are in marketing and finance. And then my junior year of undergraduate, I'm the youngest boy, and then I had twin sisters in the middle and an oldest sister. And my oldest sister, unfortunately, was a drug addict from the time she was 16. And then I had the twins in the middle and then me. And when I was a junior in college, my twin sister was diagnosed with cancer. And it was a very, very, very painful cancer tumor that was impinging on nerves and on the nervous system. And then she had to do chemotherapy, and the chemotherapy would burn the nerves. And so I would take her to MD Anderson Cancer Hospital here in Houston and would visit with her pain physician on a regular basis. And I would come home and go to these appointments with her. And I watched her go through this process. And unfortunately, she passed away. And her pain oncologist actually attended her funeral, which is pretty rare for an oncologist to go to one of his patients or her patient's funerals. But he did. And after the funeral, he came up to me and said, why don't you come to my office in next week? And I looked at him and said, is something wrong with me? Is something my sister, should I be worried? And he said, no, I just want to visit with you. And so I went to his office and sat down with his nurse, was his wife at the time. And the three of us sat down and he said to me, he said, what are you going to do next? And I said, well, I'm going to work on my MBA. And he said, you could do that. And I said, well, thank you. And he said, I watched you for the last few years with your sister having cancer and the pain that she went through. And he said, I did my pain fellowship and I've worked with oncology pain my entire career. And there's something in you that you have a natural ability to help others with pain. And he said, I really think you should look at that. And he said, I'm giving a lecture at the university medical school that I went to. Why don't you come with my wife and I? And I'd love to give you a tour of the school. And so I did. And sure, why not? And, I wasn't planning on it. So I went with he and his wife, went to the lecture that he gave, and it changed my life. And so I went back to school and did an undergraduate in psychology. And then I went on all the way for another 12 years of school. And that's really how I became the specialist that I am today, is because of my sister's experience with chronic pain. And then my oldest sister's experience with addiction. And so my core clinical specialty has been chronic pain and dual addiction, and for 30 something years.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. A lot of people are really scared to go near those areas. I recently, as a life coach, it's my parallel career, I call it, to being an artist, started working with the families of addicts. It was an area that I never thought I'd go into. So I'm particularly interested because I was scared to go near people that have lost sons and lost daughters, or husbands are horrible to live with and vice versa. And it's a really incredible, beautiful area I see now, to be able to hold people's pain with them and help them navigate it and move forward with life. So I commend you so much. I do have a curiosity question around this, though. Do you believe that there's more mental health issues today compared to previous generations, more addiction? And if so, what do you see going on? What's the root cause, really, of the increase, if there is an increase?
Yeah, I absolutely believe that there is a significant increase. I think it's probably 4, 5, 6, 7 times higher than it was in our parents' generation, even. In the 60s, there was a lot of people using pot and marijuana and LSD and things like that. But it's so interesting. You see a lot of very high functioning individuals today who went through a period in the 60s and 70s and used pot or even LSD or even cocaine recreationally, and they were able to put it down and walk away, right? Mm-hmm. And they were able to grow up, right? And they said, I need to finish school. I need to have a productive life. This was my fun, and I'm moving on. And for some reason, and I'll talk about some of those reasons in a minute, it's probably 5, 6, 7 times higher now. We're not seeing people put it down and walk away. We're seeing people pick it up and say, oh my gosh, this gave me this intense feeling that I'm missing in my life. And their brain and their body becomes physically and psychologically addicted to the substance. And they continue to use it to replace something that's missing in their life, i.e. emotions, emotional support, love, whatever trauma, whatever hole they feel like they have, and many times they don't even know or recognize what that hole is, they just use and they feel better when they use, but they don't look internally to see what that is. So I think that in our current times with technology, with COVID, with so much stress, politics in our lives, all of the things going on in our life, we see people at a younger and younger and younger age picking up marijuana and other substances, even drinking, and not putting it down, but becoming, unfortunately, lifelong addicts. And so many of those people lose their lives to their addiction. But yes, yeah. it's increased significantly, and I think it has a lot to do with the state of our world.
That says so much to me, because I think a lot of us are scared to really reflect, and I'm big on reflection and looking inward and self-discovery. But it makes me think we must be lonelier than ever. Yeah. We must be, you know, family units and things are different these days. The loneliness because of online is so different. And there's so many things, and I'm sure there's lots of papers on this sort of stuff that's actual research that you're far more knowledgeable of. But what do you believe humans need to really thrive in wellness? And what insights have you discovered regarding things like self-love, encompassing the body, mind, and spirit? Because I know that you look at emotion and its connection to pain as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'll say one of the things I loved about your website, or that I love about your website, is you use a phrase. I don't remember exactly how you use it. You'll tell me in a second, but the 360 degree
look. Oh, I love that.
Right?
Yeah.
I love that wording. And what I say every single day of my life, probably to families with whom I'm working, is we look at the human body from a 360 degree circle, mind, body, spirit, biopsychosocial approach to life. And that means that when we're missing one piece of it, whether it's spiritual, whether it's emotional, whether it's body, whatever is wrong in our system of that 360 degrees, if we tackle just that, there's 359 other degrees, right? Mm. That also need to be looked at. Because that one pinpoint affects every other one of those spokes around the wheel, right? In
Absolutely.
Our body.
Yeah.
And so I think I went off track just a little bit, but what I think is that, you know, certainly we need nurturing, and what's happened in our lives, our age people, is we're seeing gamers, we're seeing video games, we're seeing even 30 and 40 year old men and women who are not functioning, but sitting in front of a TV screen, playing video games in their 30s and 40s, living at home, or even in a marriage, but the marriage is going horribly because they're so addicted to the video games and technology or TV screens or cell phone screens. And we just stare and look. And I'm sure you see this all the time. But when you're in a restaurant, if you look around a restaurant, you even see couples that are sitting at a booth or a table and they're both on their phone, just texting and looking. And then they'll put the phone down and just kind of sit like this. Mm. And they're not really talking to each other, but they're in this public restaurant in a space where it would be amazing to be able to have that communication and fun and laughter in that environment. But we're missing so much of that because of all of the advancements in our society. So there's great advancements, and it can also harm us.
I love that you said that, because I once did a mission in Soweto, which sounds a little cliche, but it was very eye-opening because it was in South Africa, and I walked and they had everything but nothing.
Yeah.
And I mean by everything is they were community. They had a little simple houses, but they cleaned and took such pride in them. They didn't have screens or anything like that. And I remember thinking they're so wealthy in different ways. And it really challenged me. And part of me wants to take my kids to these places so that they can get perspective on what's going on in life and how far we've come and maybe how we might be able to bring back some of the things that are causing all of this stuff going on. But I'm particularly interested in people's emotional responses regarding pain. My husband's a very renowned physical therapist in the performing arts world, and he has always said so much pain is emotional. It's a very interesting area. I'll have to introduce you another time. But particularly in the context of chronic disease and pain, including like depression and anxiety, I think I saw in your podcast that 70% of physical pain, is that correct, is an emotional response?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that? Because that is mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. So I'm so glad you asked that question. And I really hope that all of your listeners hear this and this gives them just a little bit of information that they can help friends and family and even themselves with if they have chronic pain. and your husband has seen this as a physical therapist, probably his entire career. Mm-hmm. But pain obviously is physical and pain is emotional. And the only way that we feel physical pain is through our brain. Right? Our brain feels that physical pain. The only way our brain receives that signal is through our nervous system. From the tips of our fingers and the tips of our toes, all of the nerves hit the spinal cord, go straight up the spinal cord into the brain stem, and then into the brain, into the pain center of the brain. And so when we have an injury, it sends signals to the brain, and the brain says, oh, pull your finger off the hot stove, right? Or, oh, I fell off a curb, and it instantly hurts, right? Sometimes that pain doesn't stop. And I believe that a lot of our physical pain is a misfiring of the nervous system, right? Our bodies were designed to heal within about 90 days. No matter what trauma is given to our body, our bodies are really designed to, the tissue and the bones are supposed to heal within that 90-day period. Sometimes, about 25% of the time in the population, it doesn't, and that signal keeps firing. So if you can imagine feeling that pain signal 24 hours a day for months and months and months and years, you begin to, at months, early months, 3-4 months, you start not sleeping, you feel anxious, like, is this ever going to go away? And then it turns into depression. And then that depression turns into more sleeplessness, and sleeplessness and anxiety increase the movement of the nervous system. And what that does then is it sends the signal of the pain faster to the brain. So it increases the rate of the pain signal as our nervous system is responding with anxiety or sleeplessness. Then we feel physical pain at a higher level because that signal is traveling much faster. I know, even as in a simplified term, if I personally don't sleep 6 hours a night, at least 6 hours, the next day around 2 o'clock, I can notice I'm kind of like have a little slight tremor, or I just don't feel good. I'm tired and I feel a little bit anxious, right? Like I'm tired and I'm anxious, but I have a lot to do. And I need that sleep, 6 to 8 hours of sleep. And when I don't get it, I just don't feel good. And when you don't feel good for weeks and months at a time, depression, anxiety, fear, avoidance, social isolation, all of those emotional impacts begin to increase that level of pain. So all over the world in 2024, we rate our pain on a 0 to 10 scale. There's no device that we can touch a body with or that we can say, let's plug this in and touch your body and feel what level of pain you're in, or it'll be a meter. It's so subjective. Everybody has their own idea of what their pain level is, but it's 0 to 10, no pain, or what we call emergency room pain. So everyone's idea of that is different. And but what we know is, and what every medical journal that deals with chronic pain or physicians who write articles and do research and scientists who do research on pain will tell you is that if we can do away with the emotional impact, in other words, the anxiety, the fear, the depression, the trauma of pain, we see about a 70% decrease in their physical pain almost immediately. Wow. So for instance, I can work with a patient in one session and who comes into my office and says, today I'm feeling a level 9 pain. And I can walk them through a meditation. I can walk them through a breathing exercise. I can walk them through, you know, they can do yoga with us. They can do whatever it is that calms their nerves and anxiety. And after 30 minutes or so, you ask them again, what is your pain level? It is amazing to hear people go, oh, I think it's about a 2, maybe a 3. Yeah. And so that triggers people to understand, oh, there is something I can do other than take an opiate or a pill or something. And so when we teach people to understand that emotional impact, they really begin to practice meditation and mindfulness and breathing and yoga and other techniques that helps them lower that emotional feeling that lowers their physical pain.
I'm loving that you say that, because I had a client who came off very heavy addiction, and his anxiety was through the roof. Mm-hmm. And he was having so much trouble. It almost wanted to push him back to the addiction. Yeah. And it was, you know, that numbing that humans do when they don't want to feel something, like, as Brené says, the tip of the thorn. We want to run away from it as fast as we can. It's horrible. Yeah. But I'm interested in the brain then, not just in the neurology, but also in the thought life. Like, how can we better operate our brains to thrive? What do you see going on?
Yeah, I think that you're exactly right when you say that. Our brains, I want to say this, and I tell my patients this every day and families this every day. This thing in our head right here called a brain is the single most powerful thing on the face of this earth, I believe, other than God, right? And this brain, with this brain, we can literally achieve anything that we want to achieve. We can manifest whatever it is that we want to manifest in our lives, whether it's success, whether it's happiness, whether it's a career, whether it's a marriage, whether it's a relationship, whatever it is, we can use this. And the problem with the state of our world today is many of us just aren't using this because we're so busy in traffic. We're so busy taking care of kids and working and cooking and doing everything in our lives that have to be done throughout the day and the evening, that we don't stop and pause and take care of ourselves. We change the oil in our car, or we have it changed, right? And we fill the car up with gas when it needs to have fuel, but we don't take care of ourselves. And part of that negativity that we experience and people experience in their lives is because we're not using this brain to exercise or to eat better, to sleep better, to communicate better, more effectively. And then through cognitive behavioral changes, in other words, changing a paradigm from a negative thought to a positive thought, can really change our entire outlook in our lives. And I'm sure you notice this every day. It's easier for people, unfortunately, to think negative thoughts than it is positive thoughts.
Totally.
It's so wild, but it is. When you sit, again, I'm going to use the restaurant. When you go to lunch today, if you're sitting at a restaurant, you have three tables around you. Two of those three tables are talking about negative things.
100%.
We don't sit and talk about the great things in our lives. The news that comes to us in the morning while we're getting dressed, in the evening when we're before dinner or what have you, and watching it, it's all negative. So we're just fed negative thoughts constantly. And if we can use our brain to turn that around and turn that negativity around and stop ourselves cognitively and consciously into more positive thinking, and visualizing what we want and what we need, how we physically want to feel, how we emotionally want to feel, what we want our relationships to be like, and what we want our success, our finances, or anything else in our life to be. If you focus on that, you can reach that goal.
Oh my goodness. I've been saying it, it's not something I've heard somewhere, but I keep saying to my husband, our whole quality of life is in our head.
You're so right.
And he just looks at me and he's like, yeah. And I see that from clients that I have. I'm like, it's really, and of course the work of Byron Katie as well. And you know, just seeing how people deal with chronic pain by changing their beliefs. I mean, incredible, really. Can you tell me, I'm sure you hear this every day, when someone says to you, what's wrong with me? Or they're just asking that. They haven't even verbalized it. What do you do with that when they have no idea and they're just like, what's wrong with me? What do you
exactly.
do with that?
That is a great question. And probably almost every day of my life, someone says, what's wrong with me? Right? That's what I do, is solve problems. Very, very complex problems. Yeah. But my response typically is a little bit of a giggle and just say, I have no idea, but let's explore together, right?
Nice.
if you'll be open, and if someone will sit in front of me and really be open with, I I use the word vomit, right? I say, if you will sit here with me for whether it's an hour or 3 hours and just vomit everything that we talk about and hold nothing back, we're going to find out what's wrong with you, right? And there's probably not that much wrong with you. It's behaviors and actions that you have that you can change. You're beautiful and perfect in every way, other than this brain and the thoughts that you have that cause negative behavior, which give negative consequences. So let's figure out what causes those thought processes, right? Of using marijuana or using cocaine or using heroin or alcohol or whatever it is, and go to the root cause of that and figure out, and let's address that root cause. And then you're going to see all the beauty of yourself in your life.
That sounds so beautiful, the way that you put it. And I just want to go back to your story a little, because it's deeply personal, and you've been through horrible trauma and loss. Can you tell us a little more of, other than your sisters, there were other members in your family that were addicts. Can you share about that?
Sure, I'm happy to. I believe that that disclosure and personal disclosure, when we talk about our own lives to patients and people who are suffering, and they understand that you too have suffered but overcome, I think it really helps raise their ability to overcome their own trauma. And you know, I'm from an interesting family, and from a very small town in South Texas. I grew up on a ranch, and my grandfather was a surgeon, and he owned and built the hospital, the first hospital in this little town, and then grew that. And part of my family was in the oil and gas business in South Texas. And so there was lots of success in my family, perceived success. And the other part of it is everyone was either an alcoholic or a drug addict. My grandfather, who was a surgeon, and I laugh, but you know, sometimes laughing kind of gets you on. But my grandfather was a cocaine addict who eventually got into recovery as a physician. My mother's mom and dad both died from cirrhosis of the liver, from alcoholism. My mother she married my father when she was 16. She was a beauty queen in South Texas, and she was Miss South Texas and homecoming queen. And, you know, my father was the quarterback of his football team and all of this. And
all the things.
So they met and fell in love, married 2 weeks later at their senior year of high school. They eloped and got married. And then my father treated my mother horribly. He cheated on her, and he was a heavy drinker, and he was a workaholic. And so my grandfather would give my mother Valium to feel better.
Wow.
Here, just take this Valium and you'll feel better. And so she would take the Valium. And so my siblings and I were really raised by a nanny who I call my mom. And she lived until she was 94, and she just passed away last year. But she was really worked within our family system for 60 years of my life. I'm 59. So my whole life, really, until last year. And, but gosh, the addiction was rampant in my family. And I can remember, and then my sister, my oldest sister she was pulled over by the Texas Highway Patrol when she was 16. And they found, I don't remember the amount, but quite a bit of cocaine in her car.
Oh, nice.
And instead of taking her to jail, they brought her home and they said, tell her not to do this.
Oh, no.
You know, instead of a consequence, right?
Yeah,
they just bring her home and say, we found your daughter doing this, and she has this much cocaine in her car, and she was planning on selling it. We're not going to arrest her because of who you are. We love you guys, but tell her not to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. Zero consequences. And so it continued. And then my sister, unfortunately, went to treatment about 10 or 12 times, maybe even more than a dozen times. And then she decided to move to Portland, Oregon, where she could start a new life. And my grandparents bought her a little small condominium on the 8th floor of a building, and she moved in. And 2 weeks after moving in, she had a party, and all these people were there. And the next morning, or that night, in the middle of the night, my mother had a phone call, and she had fallen from the 8th story balcony to the street and died. And everyone in the party ran and scattered, right? So the police didn't know what happened. There were no cameras outside at the time, you know, when she passed or when she fell. And we don't know how she fell off the balcony, but either she was pushed, she jumped, she was high, something. But what we do know is she had several drugs in her system. And living that as a child and growing up and seeing that, I can remember at eight, nine years old, looking at my family going, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
This is insanity. And I don't want to be, I love them, but I don't want to be crazy like these people.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of me becoming a drug addict or an alcoholic, what I did is I put my head down and I studied and I loved school. And I did not miss a day of school from the 1st grade to the 12th grade, not one day of school, because it was, I felt safer and enjoyed school more than I enjoyed being at home and seeing the insanity in my own family. And so then I went off to college and just continued, as you can tell, when we were talking about going back to school. And instead, I became a student-aholic, right? And really type A personality, typical adult child of an alcoholic, and multiple alcoholics in my family, multiple deaths in my family. My father, when I was 10 years old, took my sister, my oldest sister, to treatment. It was her second attempt at treatment when I was 10. And he came home. He had driven all day to take her to treatment, drove home. He got out of the car, walked in the house. Our nanny, who was kind of like my mother, put dinner on the table, and we were sitting around the table, and my twin sisters were there. My mother was there. I was there, and my dad, and we were eating dinner, and all of a sudden he looked at me and he literally grabbed his chest and he fell over and died at having dinner with us. And so I saw my father die when I was 10 years old. And that has an impact on children. It has an impact on my sisters, who were 5 years older than me at the time. They were 15, 16. And it had an impact on my mother, of course, a negative impact by increasing the amount of Valium and drugs that she used until she eventually ended up in recovery. But what I did, for some reason, and again, I attribute this to probably God saving my life and saying, you're not going to be like this. And I just said to my mother when I was 12 years old, I think I want to see a therapist.
Wow.
She's like, what? And I said, I think I want to see a therapist.
Yeah.
And she's like, okay. And so I started going to a group therapy with a therapist in Corpus Christi, Texas, when I was 12 years old. And it was a group of 8 or 10 other boys. And we would sit in therapy twice a week and just talk about our issues and problems and what was happening. And she was the most amazing therapist. And I really attribute part of my career to her for inspiring me to help other people and help myself. But I just, you know, yes, I'm a workaholic, probably. Yes, I'm a study-aholic and a academic-aholic. But I didn't go down the route of addiction and alcohol and drugs. Interestingly, the career that I have is working with addiction and mental health and complicated medical problems. And I've never smoked pot. I've never used cocaine. I've never, you know, I just said I was repulsed by it. It had the opposite effect because I saw what it did to my whole family.
My son is 10. So when you share that, it's very real to hear that, because I can really picture him and if that was our family. And it's, I'm amazed. And I mean, it's incredible, but by grace that you have flipped your life the way you have, because, you know, obviously it's not always the way that it goes.
Phew, today's masterclass is done. I love reaching back and saying I've done this and helping you learn the easy way. If you want more, head to larabiancapilcher.com for show notes, links, freebies, my blog, coaching and courses, and you can also head to my socials, Lara Bianca Pilcher on Instagram and Facebook. I'm also on Twitter and Pinterest. Thanks again for listening. Please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. That would mean the world to me. And of course, keep on living the healthy, wealthy, wise artist living towards your dream life. Bye, friends. P.S. Shout out to my hottie hubby, Andrew Pilcher, who does all the editing on this podcast.